This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about eating disorders. So to start off with, I've got a definition from Wikipedia. They said, an eating disorder is a mental disorder defined by abnormal eating habits that negatively affect a person's physical or mental health. So in the UK, according to the Priory Group, 1.6 million people are affected by an eating disorder. In the episode itself, we're chatting to a male guest, and as a fellow male who deals with anorexia, I was really keen to show how this condition can affect people of all genders. All too frequently, even nowadays, it's seen as a gendered condition. It's also often seen as something that affects young people or specifically teens. And whilst in many cases that can be when the condition starts, as we discuss a little bit in the episode, the effects of that are often lifetime, even if that person manages to maintain healthy, regular eating habits through the rest of their life. So with this in mind, the next statistic I have is from the National Eating Disorder Association, who found males represent 25% of individuals with anorexia nervosa, and they are at a higher risk of dying, in part because they are often diagnosed later, since many people assume males don't have eating disorders. So that statistic I found incredibly powerful and really sad because it encapsulates how important it is to understand it can affect anyone. And particularly when it comes to eating disorders, this is an example of how the stigma and the lack of understanding can actually lead to the very worst of outcomes. So the next statistic I have is for America, with America being our second biggest listener base. The National Eating Disorder Association, they found that 10 million American men suffer from diagnosable conditions such as anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating. And it's more likely many more suffer from other types of disordered eating. So we'll just touch on briefly the different types of eating disorders, because equally, as much as many people think of the conditions potentially fitting a certain type of person, they can also assume that having an eating disorder means your body is a certain way. In fact, the current NHS regulations limit those that are dealing with eating disorders in part based on their weight. And for many people, this can lead to them not getting help as soon as they need it, or can actively exclude certain people that just happen to have really unhealthy relationships with food, but because their BMI isn't below a certain threshold, aren't considered worthy of the help. This is deeply concerning, and I've known personally of many situations where this has held people back from getting the support they so desperately need. In fact, there's actually a campaign going on at the moment by a campaigner called Hope Virgo, and so I'm going to put a link to that in the description. And her campaign is all around taking the weight requirements out of the diagnosis and treatment of eating disorders. It's something I'm hugely passionate about, and I'd love to send over a few more signatures her way. So before we get into the episode, I also wanted to touch on a little bit further the different types of eating disorders as well. So they are, as I said, so much broader than just someone being a certain weight. So I'm just going to quote from some information I found from the NHS. That is, eating disorders, including anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and other specific feeding or eating disorders, are responsible for more loss of life than any other mental health condition, and unfortunately are becoming increasingly more common. So this, again, gives you an idea of the scale of what we're dealing with these types of conditions, but also the range of them. A condition like binge eating disorder would frequently result in weight gain rather than the weight loss that can be stereotyped with eating disorders. So to give you a bit of background into our guest, he deals with anorexia, as do I. The full term for that is anorexia nervosa, and I have a quick definition from the NHS on what that is. Anorexia is an eating disorder and serious mental health condition. People who have anorexia try to keep their weight as low as possible by not eating enough food or exercising too much or both. This can make them very ill because they start to starve. They often have a distorted image of their bodies, thinking they are fat even when they are underweight. So that's a quick summary of how it presents itself. The way they describe there is typical of someone who is very actively experiencing the condition. Many people describe it a little bit like we describe addiction, in that you can be recovered, but there's always a chance of relapse. It's not seen as binary in most cases of you being cured. It's more a case of you are maintaining a healthy lifestyle despite the condition, and there can be risks for falling back into unhealthy patterns if you don't look after yourself and to some extent keep up an active part in maintaining these healthy boundaries and habits. So in a moment, we'll get into the episode with our guest, Tom Robert. Just some quick info on him. He was announced as the Prince's Trust Young Ambassador of the Year in 2018 in recognition of turning his life around and raising awareness of eating disorders in men and the impact on mental health. He's someone that I find incredibly inspirational to follow online, but also to get the privilege to interview in person. He's a delight. I think he'll be fascinating for you guys to listen to. He certainly moved me a lot in hearing his story. One other thing we discuss in the episode is autism, and that is in many cases a really significant factor in mental health. We actually did an episode very early on in the podcast that you can find if you scroll right back if you want to learn a bit more about how autism and mental health can interact. So that's all I need to say for now. We'll get into the episode with Tom in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So I'm Tom Robert. Best way I always like to spell my name is kind of repair, but with a B instead of a P. So that's a bit of a fun fact.
I love
fact
that.
There. But I started with mental health issues probably from a really young age. I've always struggled with like kind of self-worth and self-confidence, and that kind of is always been like in the background thing. Obviously, it's not mental health issue, but I think a lot of that kind of relates to it. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of started with like panic attacks when I was only probably about 12 or something, 12, 13. I think when I was at school, I was getting bullied a lot. I got bullied quite a bit because I always wanted to work hard and try my best, but unfortunately the classes I was in, or the classes I was placed into, were always like the bottom end of the classes. So because I struggled with like mastering English, with being dyslexic, unfortunately the other students in there, some of them weren't as keen to work. They were just kind of, yabbing on and doing different things.
I have dyslexia, so I was those children you described.
But yeah, it was. Some of them were like fine, but some of them did bully us a lot and did pick on us, and I was kind of the outcast. Mm. I've always felt the outcast. It's really weird. I've always felt, even from earlier than 12, I would have said like 8, I felt like I'm this different person. And so, yeah, I struggled then. And then that kind of led to probably causing anxiety. But at the time, I didn't really know. I knew I had panic attacks because my mum, she suffered a lot with them when she was younger, when she was in her 20s. And when I started to have these panic attacks and shaking and tense muscles and sweating and clamminess and feeling like I just wanted to escape or run away and fearful and awake at like 2 o'clock in the morning, like I shouldn't have been. She knew straight away, oh, it's a panic attack, you know, if you're sick, you're feeling like this. And and she was great. She helped kind of calm us down when I was really young and helped things sort things out. And what was really weird in a way was I used to find there used to be a certain day. I used to have in my mind, oh, the certain day I would have a panic attack. And it actually did become this kind of routine. If it was like a Wednesday night, I would say, oh, it's Wednesday night. And I would probably actually really, it's hard because it was a cycle of, I was thinking it's a Wednesday night. So I would kind of convince myself that I was going to have a panic attack. At the same time, it would then happen. Mm-hmm. So then it would correlate even more. And the correlation would get stronger and stronger. And it was something very hard to break. Sometimes I used to even get physical symptoms in terms of not just shaking and feeling anxious and things. Sometimes I would be a bit sick with it. And then that would cause us to feel like, oh, I'm really ill, I'm this. And then sometimes I would stay off school. But actually, my mum did know that actually really it was just anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So that went on for a while. And it wasn't until basically I had this massive big breakdown when I was about 13, like this massive big breakdown.
So before we get into that, I just have a few questions about what you said so far. You talked about being an outsider, feeling like an outsider from a young age. Are you able to look back on now and see where that might have come from? Was there any kind of discrimination you face like outside of school or like within the school environment that sort of led up to that, or was that something more innate that came from you?
I think there's a few things actually. Now, just recently I've been diagnosed being autistic, which one of the biggest signs of it is feeling very different and doing things in a kind of normal way of doing things in life. But I think sometimes my family will joke on and say, oh, that's like a really different way of doing stuff and there's a different way of learning things. And I think that could be a major factor. I think it's just about you always want to fit in. You want to fit in with everyone at school, don't you?
It's like a boiled down average of like, here's roughly the in-between how everyone should be.
Yeah.
And actually it doesn't make for a very interesting character.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's like, you could say like having a jigsaw or something, trying to have like all these different pieces and saying, oh, well, this jigsaw goes together, but actually in reality it doesn't, and you don't realise that until you're a bit older. And actually, this puzzle just can't be done. So I think there can be a lot of factors, feeling like different and feeling like an outsider. I never really socialised very well as well. I was always alone. I was always at lunch on my own, dinner on my own, break time on my own. My whole day was just basically spent on my own, pretty much. And I couldn't really go in the library or anything and read because I found that really difficult anyway. So it was a really challenging time.
And how did you feel at that time? Because I think even from a young age, we get an like instinctive idea of like what you described there, this idea of normal. There's this like constant comparison that goes on between you and your peers. And so how aware of that were you at the time that other people were better socialised than you were?
I don't think I was aware of it at all, really, to be honest. I just did what I had to do, you know. I knew I had to go to school in a way, and I knew I had to just survive. It sounds weird, but yeah, survive. So I just stayed on my own. I just did my work as best as I could. If there was somebody, the odd person I'd speak to, is I'd talk back to them and speak a bit. But there wasn't anything really I did massively. And I think that's how kind of going on to the next point of I had a kind of breakdown was probably because of that reason, was I was actually just dealing with it and trying to survive, but actually inside I was just breaking and breaking up more mm-hmm. and more.
Yeah, because I like the word you've used there, surviving, because that's how it felt like. It's a strong word, but that's how it felt for me, I think, when I was really young and not feeling like I fitted in. I felt this kind of like innate need that I need to look after myself because I wasn't convinced anyone else would. I knew that I had to stick up for myself for being different. So, no, I think survival is spot on.
Yeah. It's weird how kind of things work in life. Weird how looking back on situations and thinking in hindsight about how things might work and how you could have changed it or done things differently. But I don't think, to be honest, I don't think I could have really done anything much different, even looking back now. Just the only difference I would do now is I would have more understanding of myself,
mm-hmm.
and really actually these people in this kind of situation doesn't really matter too much. But I suppose if you go into it every day, five days out of seven, and it feels like a lifetime, doesn't it? You're born and then you go to school, and it's really bizarre when you leave school because you think actually it's just going to keep happening for the rest of your life. You never think that anything's going to change. You never actually think, oh, actually, I'm going to become an adult, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to have a family, and I'm going to have a car. You just think, I'll go to school, I'll get up, put my pajamas on, do this, go to school, do this, come home, play on the PlayStation, back to school. It's just this real big cycle, and until you leave school, until the teacher says, yeah, actually, you've only got a week or a month, and then that's it, you're finished, you're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, so...
Yeah, well, I've always thought that school, the best thing it prepares you for is more school.
Yeah. So the next thing, really, like I say, was kind of had this massive breakdown when I was probably a year old, so I was about 13. And basically that led to me becoming physically unwell. I lost weight, I looked unwell, I was being sick, it was coming out the other end. And it was all to do with kind of like nerves and stress, and some of my hair was falling out at the time. Not a lot, but a little bit. And it was just sort of things. I was looking really unwell, and my mum said, enough's enough. And she actually kept us off school for a good 2 or 3 months.
Mm.
I think she kept ringing the school saying he's not coming in until there's something sorted out, until he gets put into a class that's more suitable for him. If he's happier, more settled, and pretty much we kind of stuck to our guns. And then eventually the headmaster came to the house, and we basically discussed that, and we said, oh, I would like to be in, like, I was in like a second bottom, and I did know somebody who I was more friendly with in second top, and I said, oh, I would like to move to second top.
And these are like sets?
Yeah, the sets, yeah, right? And it's awful really to think the sets for how clever you are, basically.
And even looking back on it, the language is quite funny, because I was the same, like, having dyslexia, I was often in the bottom set. And the fact that it was even referred to as that is quite odd in hindsight. Like,
yeah, it's pretty awkward, because again, it's just so categorising you, and it just dehumanises you. It's awful. Actually.
Yeah, well, because, you know, young people at those kind of ages, we're still very much figuring out how we are. Definitely. So if the teachers that you look up to say, oh, you've got to be in this class, it's difficult not to equate your value to that.
Yeah, definitely. And that just, I think that just messes with your head so much. Even looking back on it now, it looks like it messes with your head more than I actually thought, you know? So anyway, the headmaster said, that's not possible. It just can't be done. And I said, well, my mum basically said, look, he can't come back. He would have to find another way. You'd have to either be homeschooled or tutored or whatever. And they said, oh, we'll have to go away. They went away. They rang up about the end of that day. And they said, oh, we're going to try it. We're going to trial it. So Tom can go in second top and just see how he goes, really. And so I did. And the people in there just seemed a lot more wanting to work and jump around as much. They were just, I don't know, it just was a quieter class.
Yeah, more matched with your work.
Yeah, and they thought, they told all the teachers, so all the teachers kind of expected me to really quite struggle with the work and really kind of be at the bottom of the class. But actually, when they found out about 3 months into it, they had a good review, and they came back to me and said, well, actually, Tom's actually not just in the class, he's actually classed average in terms of grades.
Mm-hmm.
And
great.
I was like, what? And they were like, I know, you're kind of like defined in science because you should be a bottom set kind of thing, you know? And then all of a sudden you would put you the second top, and you were like defined the science of, you're not just holding yourself, you're like in the middle, you're doing really well. So they couldn't believe it. And I think that just shows again how these sets are just, they're kind of nothing. They're really nothing. They put these stickers, oh, you've got to be in this set and that set. And really, actually, if you're quite happy, which I was fairly happy, you'll just perform whatever you're given, you know? And if you're given harder work and you're happy, you will achieve it. You will get better marks. So that went on for probably a year and a half, and got a GCSE, and everyone moved again, and things changed again, obviously. And again, from then, my school life was alright. I still had problems like everyone else, and it still didn't feel brilliant, but I guess, again, I survived. I kind of went every day, and when I left school and I went to college, I remember the first year being in college, used to go on, like, we'd start at, like, 8:30, and then you'd go, Christ, 8:30? I don't start till 9. And I'd actually convinced myself so much that actually I was always late for that 30 minutes, you know? And at 3 o'clock, like, I would look at my watch and I would go, oh, it's 3 o'clock, we should be done now, we should be done. And I'd be chomping at the bit. But actually, I had like another hour to go because it was college, yeah. It wasn't school, you know? And I was like, I remember actually really hating it, thinking, I hate this. They keep getting longer, the longer days.
And were you aware of the reasons why? Because my understanding with autism is that one of the like key factors is routine. You know, having that kind of regularity, knowing what you're doing day to day. So do you think that was a factor for you in finding those changes?
Yeah, actually, thinking about it, that's great. That's a really good point. Like I say, I've just been diagnosed now with being autistic, and yeah, it could have been a major kind of thing.
Yeah, because that's really what you were centering your life around up to that point.
Basically. So, yeah, and I think leaving school is such a pivotal point in your life, because you're not just wondering who you are as such, you're not just wondering on what you want to do, who you are, what you like, what you don't like. You also have kind of society around you, your family around you, asking you, what do you want to do? You've never really worked, so you don't really know what work is. And I think that's kind of caused a bit of what happened within the middle, which was when I started my eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And that was between the first year of college and kind of coming up with the second year of college. And there was lots of factors in that point. I had a lot of family issues going on as well. Like, I had... we're dealing with my mum's dad. Her dad was dying of lung cancer, where it was actually prostate, but he was diagnosed about 10 years ago prior to this, and it just kind of, it was coming to a head basically. It was coming to this point where we were seeing him kind of get to his final stages and stuff, and what happened is the lung cancer basically spread all over his body and became prostate cancer. And I was always very close to him. I remember we used to sit and talk, and some of the things we used to talk about were, I used to laugh because all of the old stories and some of the things he used to tell us, used to make us, like, even now, just thinking about it, it's putting a good smile on my face. So, yeah. In a game, when you lose someone so close to you, no one tells you. You never get taught at school or anywhere how to deal with grief.
No.
It's such a big thing, you know, massive.
And I think in society in general, we're really awful at talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry seems to be the best response anyone can think of.
Yeah.
And it's generally not that helpful.
Yeah, definitely. Because like you say, my granddaddy died at Marie Curie, the hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I work there now. And a lot of people who I mention, I work there, straight away, everyone, oh, that's a sad place. That's a really bad place. But actually, it's not at all, you know. Lots of people die there, lots of people are very unwell there, but it's a place where you can reflect and you can kind of celebrate their life, their stories they've had to tell, their reasons on why they do things, reasons on how they've done it, how they've lived their life. You can really sit down and relax and think about all them things, and it really might make you upset and cry and confused, but at the same time, it's a time to just feel that way and accept that way, you know, and kind of let it out.
I think that's a really wonderful way of putting it, because, yes, it is such a sad situation, but your whole role is there to bring joy and to help people make peace with potentially terminal cancer. And that's such an incredible and inspiring pursuit.
Yeah, and for me personally, I've never seen death as a fear. I've just seen it as it's a progression to life. You live, your journey through your life is kind of not planned out for you, but it's you choose to a certain extent, but then sometimes then consequences and then reactions are things like luck and just things that happen without your control, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No one can predict certain things.
Absolutely. And death is really the only certain part of life.
Yeah.
So to me, it's always made sense that people should have the opportunity to round out their life and, you know, in that period coming up to death, in the way that feels most comfortable for them.
Yeah, definitely. I would always agree that, yeah, that you kind of do what you want to do at the last end, and you kind of celebrate your journey, really.
And out of interest with that, obviously you having the personal connection to this, do you see a lot of your granddad in the patients you deal with?
I think yes and no. I remember when I went in, he was only in there a week because he was that unwell. And I remember I went in and visited him, and I did feel very scared going in. It was a place I didn't know. I was only about 17, and I remember I was just lying there. There was things going off, there was buttons going off. It felt a very overwhelming place.
Mm-hmm.
But actually going there, working there now, I always imagine it is something you've been scared of for years and years. Kind of like, I keep getting this vision of the part in Home Alone where he goes down to the basement and there's this big black kind of boiler thing, and he's like, oh my god, and it's all spooky and terrifying, and he runs up the stairs and he's panicking, and it's terrifying. But then actually when he goes down there and he stays down there and he puts the light on, he realizes actually it's just a boiler. It just heats the water up. It just makes these noises to heat the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's the exact same thing where I work at Mary Geary. I work there now, and it's like somebody's put this light on and realised, and all these noises are still going off, but somebody said, right, well, that noise is for this and that noise is for that, and there's nothing scary about this at all. It's a very peaceful place. It's just these things all around her.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see in kind of both sense how I can kind of relate to kind of seeing other people in them and seeing how they felt and how I felt. Definitely. It can be quite upsetting when you see the family and stuff, and you know how much when they're upset and they're crying, you know. You kind of, we don't know exactly how much pain they're in, but you have an idea. I've been there, you know. It's awful, you know. It's empty. It's hollow.
Mm-hmm.
You just want that person back. And you just can't get it.
But it sounds really lovely that you've had that kind of full circle experience where you've been able to go in afresh to that kind of environment and learn more, and it's really demystified what all this equipment's for, what this environment's for, why it looks and sounds the way it does. Yeah. And so if we just segue back to talking about eating disorders now, I feel a lot of the problems people face with eating disorders is similarly the misunderstanding that people don't really get what they look like, what they are, or if they do come into contact with them, they see it in a very narrow light. That it takes a particular type of person, they look a particular kind of way, and there is a certain gendering still to the general perception of who can experience an eating disorder. And so do you feel that that misunderstanding complicated your ability to come to terms with that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%. When I kind of was in this period of my life, I was confused, didn't know where to turn to. People were asking us questions. People were saying, what do you want to do? Do you want to study this? Do you want to go here? I didn't particularly want to study because I've always struggled. I felt different. There was just so much going on. But at the same time, I was just kind of going to the gym with a few friends. Things, in that sense, what happened was it actually going to the gym and stuff was started working out. Like, I was getting a bit of muscle. I was developing. My whole body was changing, and it was good. But I think it was that point when things were changing that actually, that's when it kind of turned around, because I was seeing this change that I'd created from my hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time, I think, that actually in my life, I'd been at school and I'd worked hard, but actually when I'd done my GCSEs, I got very low marks. And it never worked. So I thought, anything I do is never going to work. I had this convinced in my mind, anything I do, it's just not going to happen, it's not going to work. But then when I went to the gym and I went running and I was getting faster, I was building more muscle, people were saying, friends were saying, family were saying, you're looking really good, you're developing nicely. And it was nice, I wasn't hurt by that in any sense of the word, but I realised, actually, I'm controlling this thing, I'm changing this outlook from what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Me personally, I don't fully know where it started, but I just remember that, and then I remember thinking, oh, maybe I'm eating too much. I remember particularly thinking to myself, I do eat a lot. I have like 3 meals a day, but I have snacks in between, and then sometimes I can have like a sandwich in between all the snacks and the meals, and sometimes I can have sandwich milk and crisps and smoothies, and I remember thinking, it's just getting mad how much I'm eating.
And were you eating more with the exercise increase as well?
Yeah, because I think what was happening is at that point I was exercising more, I was getting more muscle, so you use more energy there. I was probably already also very grown. I was about 17, and my dad always said he was a kind of late developer, and he says you're growing basically. You need the energy, your body's kind of needing this energy to grow taller. And I did grow a bit taller, but when I started obviously cutting down and I started reducing my intake, and I thought to myself, oh, well, I'll just not have a snack. I'll just go that extra hour, that extra half an hour, and started not listening to, I feel hungry, I feel like I need something to eat, I'm just tired, or put it down to a different excuse. Yeah, I kind of stopped going them little bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
and kind of gained control, was controlling that, but I kept the increase of exercise got more and more. And then that basically, before I knew it, it's really bizarre because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know I was actually getting thinner and thinner. I didn't know that I was becoming more and more unwell. Even, I can't even remember as such what really happened, especially getting on to the late, like when I was really unwell. I didn't know what happened. And when we did get to meet some specialists and I did get to a hospital, basically I got told that I can't remember it because actually your brain shrinks. And if your brain shrinks, it's not going to take it in. Taking in short-term memory is like the last thing your body needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last thing your body needs to survive on. So that's just gone straight away. So that's probably why there's like snippets of that period that actually I can't remember. And obviously things like my hair stopped growing, but the worst of it was actually the things we couldn't see, we didn't realise were happening. So I was getting like pains in my chest, numbness down my arms, feeling dizzy, faint, tired, weak, cold. I was like shivering. My family could see like things on the outside there, I was getting thinner and stuff, and my attitude, I was becoming very quiet. I wasn't talking at all, I was very within myself. I remember feeling quite angry. I was always angry. I'd wake up every day and I'd feel angry. And I'd always argue. If somebody said white, I would say black. And it didn't matter what it was. Even if I remember thinking to myself, arguing about something and thinking to myself, actually I agree with them, but I'm gonna argue anyway. You know, I wanna argue with them anyway because I just wouldn't do that. So it was a very, very difficult time.
And may I ask, with the argumentativeness, looking back on that, do you have a kind of idea what was causing that? Was it like the kind of mood swings and the changes from the lack of food? Or was it more so like a rebellion against other people's involvement?
I think it was more to do with the eating disorder. I think it's a big, for me personally, it's a big area that it's not very spoken of, because it's so, you could just put it down to anything, couldn't you? Oh, I was tired or this or that. It was actually part of, like you say, the mood swings, the changes in the chemicals in your body, the tiredness because you're actually not eating. Your brain's kind of starved, your body's starved. So, of course, it's going to be, people joke about hangry, don't they?
Mm.
Where you get hungry and angry. But I think actually it's true. In a way, it's actually true.
Because it's a difficult thing to explain to someone, but not eating in that way, it affects everything.
Yeah.
It's, I think, unless you've been through it, it's really difficult to wrap your head around just how all-encompassing that experience is.
There is loads of effects. The physical effects. Effects that you don't even... Well, we didn't, my family didn't really realise. Even, there's even long-term effects, so even now, I don't think I should be taller than my dad, and I'm not. So, it's hard to judge on whether my growth's been stunted, because obviously no one knows how taller I should be, but I think I should be taller than what I am, and I'm not going to get that back, you know? It's just a thing that's irreversible, and a thing that I can't change, and it's kind of a scar that's always there. There's things like your bone density can be affected massively. So I know about 3-4 years ago I had a density scan. I think your bones could be always more brittle than kind of what they should be. Again, that could be something to find out when I'm 80 odd or something, you know.
Fun surprise.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. People kind of say, eating disorders kind of only affect you when you're in your teens, or... It's just kind of looked upon as a mental health condition. It's serious, but it's not that serious. But actually, it's very serious. It can be life debilitating if you want it to be, you know.
Yeah, thing that I really noticed that I think a lot of mental illnesses don't have is that once you get bad enough with your food to be diagnosed with an eating disorder, it's almost impossible for your thinking to ever get back to normal. Like, for me, I'm aware that even when I'm eating right, I'm still doing so consciously. Like, I don't think I'll ever be able to not think about health in relation to food.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree. Like, it's such a hard thing to kind of get your head around in terms of the treatment I was used to get told by doctors was, if physically you can be well, then more mentally your brain will kind of develop, and you feel like you'll understand better on what we're saying to you. So the CBT and all that will be able to help you kind of deal with kind of eating. But the problem is it's a vicious circle, because that means you've got to eat. And the problem is, you don't want to eat because you feel bad for eating, or you want to eat and then burn it off, but you can't do that either. So, yeah, it's a horrendous circle. And, well, if you eat first, then you'll feel better, but you don't want to eat, so you need to get a CBT. But you can't have the CBT because your mind and your brain so, like, kind of shrunk that really you're just not going to take it in. It's going to go in one ear. And at the end of there, you might remember it for that next meal you're going to have, and you might kind of eat a fair amount then, and you might finish off your dinner or something that meal, but the next one, you're not going to do anything because you're going to forget, or you're going to not take it in as well. So it's such a vicious circle, and that can be so hard to break.
Yeah, and when you're at your very worst, it's like you're going against your most basic instincts.
Yeah.
Because everything within you is screaming that you shouldn't be eating.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. If you only don't eat, then it will all be fine.
Yeah.
And then you've got all these medical professionals trying to tell you the complete opposite.
Yeah. For me, I remember turning my 17th birthday, and I think it was the Olympics. I think I went to see a football match, and I was so unwell, I just didn't want to be there. I was basically sitting on the seat as a body, but in my mind, I just wanted to crawl up into a corner and then just run away. I remember having days of sitting on buses, and I would actually... It would be like everything... I remember closing my eyes and everything would kind of go dark, and it would be like as if somebody like sucking us into death, basically. It was, I could feel me heart slowing right down, and I could feel myself like labouring and breathing and getting clammy and stuff, and I remember just kind of thinking, I just want to go, you know, I just want to go and relaxing into it. But then I think I did that quite a few times, especially during the night, and I remember getting like a surge of adrenaline, and And it would be, because then I would jump up, and as I said, I would jump up literally, and I'd be like, I can't, and I would suddenly get this gasp of air and wake up and all the rest of it. I don't think it was until kind of later on that we realised actually how close I was to possibly dying, that actually me kind of falling into that state was me possibly falling into a coma, possibly falling into my heart kind of going out of rhythm because it was so low. But yeah, we just didn't know these things, because obviously, yeah, I look skinny, yeah, I looked a bit unwell, but you don't take your heart rate on a daily basis. You don't have a heart machine, so...
Yeah, that sounds so terrifying. Yeah. And did you feel a lot of pressure throughout this to cover up and to seem more okay than you were?
Yeah, in a way, yes, I did. I was always in denial, especially the first time, if I'm having a problem. I think I always just put it down to people just live like this, so this is just the way life is, so I was just always in denial of it. I would never actually admit to it. I wouldn't want to have treatment for it. I thought it was normal. Yeah, it was, or I would say to somebody, oh, I am eating, I'm not eating. Have you seen how much I'm eating? So I would eat a big meal, I might eat all my tea, so that would be a large amount. I could actually have like 2 platefuls of like food and say, oh well, there, I'm eating. But actually, I didn't tell you, about 3 hours ago I was probably like running for like 2 hours, and then I was going to my room and exercising for another half an hour 3 times a day, and then like cleaning the house top to bottom and being on my feet all day. And but yeah, I was eating.
Yeah.
And I think that's another big misconception. People really don't think, even now, oh well, if you're eating, then you haven't got an eating disorder. But that's not true at all.
It's yeah, true at all. Absolutely. And there's conditions like binge eating, which is the complete opposite.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. The thing you've reminded me of with my own experience is how easy it can be to almost like gamify the experience.
Yeah.
And even now, I sometimes catch myself having not eaten for a while, and then I feel good about it, still falling back into that way of thinking that it's an achievement.
It is really weird, like starvation in general, because when you're starving yourself, it is an actual physical thing that you do actually go through kind of more chemicals in your body, more chemical imbalance, so it does actually make you feel more energized, believe it or not. You know, I remember being in treatment and we've done loads of different sessions, and one of them was actually about how I think it's due to kind of back to cavemen and cavewomen and back to surviving again. It goes back to you've got to go out there, hunt the food, gather the food. So there's no good you feeling tired and lethargic, because how are you going to get the food to give you the energy? So it gives you like this short burst and this happy feeling of kind of euphoria sort of thing. So when you're not eating, you think, oh well, actually I feel really good, oh I feel really cheerful, I'm full of life, I feel full of energy. But it's actually until about 2 or 3 months down the line, or even sooner, all of a sudden you just crash, you just hit bang, and you just stop, and everything like crumbles in, and that's when everything starts falling in. But by that point you could have actually caused some damage, so it's really hard to kind of work out where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a complex range of conditions. Just to finish up with, first off, is there anything you'd want to tell people about if they want to learn more about you or find you online?
Yeah, definitely. So, always find us online. I'm always on Twitter, Instagram. It's just my name, so it's just Tom Robert. I would also say that at the minute, I'm going through a major thing that is kind of really changing my outlook on mental health. And that is, at the minute, my mum's got cancer. So we're having to deal with this cancer, but it's not affecting me, but I'm seeing, kind of going in hospitals all the time, seeing a very close family member become very unwell and things, and that's just has so big impact on your mental health, an impact on your mental health that I would have never really thought of, to be honest.
And particularly with you, when your mum's been so supportive of your health as well.
Yeah, definitely.
For now, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Yeah, I'm really pleased. And I'm surprised how quick it's gone, you know.
I know, yeah. It's been great chatting to you. And if we could leave just on one last thing, if perhaps anyone out there is listening to this and they think, you know, they can relate to some of these symptoms, what would you say to anyone that might need help?
Anyone can get an eating disorder. Anyone can experience an eating disorder. It comes in so many different ways. It's so well hidden. It doesn't always have to be anorexia as well. Like you say, you've got eating disorders. But whatever it is, you must get treatment. You must get support and help. Unfortunately, it can't be done on your own. It just can't be done, you know. There's certain things in your life that you can maybe get yourself through or help yourself with, but something like an eating disorder, you can't do it yourself. You've got to get support from somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I think if people can take anything away from your story, it's that the earliest intervention possible is always preferable.
Yeah, definitely, because the earlier you get the treatment, the earlier you get kind of recovered from it as such. If you haven't done that and you haven't recovered straight away, don't give up hope, you know. I know people relapse and I've relapsed, but how many times do you make a mistake kicking a football? Hundreds of times. So you relapse three times with an eating disorder. It's pretty good.
Exactly.
It's really good, isn't it?
It's not linear if you're fine or you're not fine. It's about a general kind of arc of progress.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll finish up there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Great,
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.